during the night, and is probably at the doctor as we speak. We decided it would be best for everyone concerned to go forward with the argument, and he'll listen to the tape recording of the oral argument, and then the five of us will deliberate. Are you ready to proceed?
Good afternoon. Chris Elzer, Your Honor. I'm a Carter in English on behalf of Pharmathene. I'd like to present Mr. Roger Crane, who has been admitted pro hoc vice, and with the court's permission, he will be making argument today.
Welcome to the court, Mr. Crane.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Good afternoon.
This appeal raises important issues of law about the scope of a contractual duty to negotiate in good faith and the permissible damages that may be awarded when there is a breach. Ironically, Pharmathene, the plaintiff below, did not present or argue its case as one involving a breach of the duty to negotiate in good faith. Far from it, Pharmathene contended all along that the draft license agreement term sheet, which is referred to as the LATS in the party's briefs, which was negotiated early in 2006, was itself a binding contract, although it was unsigned, bore a legend saying that it was not binding, and despite abundant evidence in the record that the parties did not intend to be bound by its terms. Pharmathene needed the Court of Chancery either to enforce the LATS as or use it as a basis for awarding expectation damages, because Pharmathene sought an award of lottery ticket damages of between $400 million to in excess of $1 billion, all for a drug that had no sales and was years away from approval or commercialization. Pharmathene's objective was to win an award based on what it hoped to achieve in a final license agreement the parties never reached, not based on what it had actually achieved in the parties' interim negotiations. In pursuit of its lottery ticket prize, Pharmathene, of course, offered no evidence of any other potential measure of damage to which it might actually have been entitled. It put on no evidence of its reliance damages, that is, how much it would have been required to make it whole, and no evidence of the extent to which SIGA, my client, actually might thought to have been unjustly enriched by Pharmathene's limited support and assistance during part of 2006. SIGA submitted evidence of Pharmathene's reliance damages showing they were only a few $100,000, and the court below accepted that. There is no evidence in the record at all of the dollar value of any unjust enrichment. These strategic decisions Pharmathene made went awry when the court correctly recognized that no deal was yet reached and no deal was guaranteed. There was only an agreement to negotiate in good faith toward a potential deal. This meant, of course, that there could be no damages based on the terms of the LATS, since the parties had never agreed to be bound by those terms. Thus, all of Pharmathene's damages evidence went out of the case, and Pharmathene could not be entitled to the golden ticket it came to court to find. The Court of Chancery did find that SIGA had breached its promise to negotiate in good faith for 90 days after the termination of the merger agreement. This was wrong for reasons I'll explain shortly.
To what extent was that a finding of fact in the determination of good faith or lack of it?
Well, I think it's based in part on an understanding of what SIGA did, but I think it's fundamentally based on a misunderstanding of what the legal standard is to find someone in violation of a duty of good faith negotiation, which I will get to shortly, Your Honor. Even if it were the case that SIGA had failed to negotiate in good faith consistent with its contractual obligations, all this means is that Pharmathene should get what it lost as a result of entering into those negotiations. Instead, the Court of Chancery committed additional error, and serious error, error that puts Delaware at odds with the law of many of its sister states, particularly those with large commercial presences and courts of business. Rather than making Pharmathene whole for the purported breach through reliance damages, the court engaged in utter speculation about what the outcome of a good faith negotiation might have been, and gave Pharmathene what it termed expectation damages based on that confected contract.
How long would the Court of Chancery need to oversee the remedy awarded in this case?
No fewer than 10 years, and very likely because the remedy goes on for 10 years. And there will undoubtedly be, I'm holding up the wrong document, but let me hold up the final judgment. The final judgment is 14 pages long. The last 8 pages consist of multiple, dozens of single-spaced definitions, all of which were made up by the court, essentially. The remedy itself is embedded in the first 8 pages of the document. But, Your Honor, I have no doubt that litigation could go on for 20 years and could embroil the Court of Chancery in endless disputes.
Isn't there a heads or I win, tails you lose aspect to a claim for a breach of the duty to negotiate in good faith? And by that I mean if any relief at all is granted, whether it's reliance damages or expectation damages, that necessarily presupposes that the negotiation would have concluded with some agreement.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And that's speculative by its very nature because that's unknowable.
It is utterly unknowable, and it's not really within the party's expectation that there will be an agreement.
Right, so that's the heads I win. The tails you lose is that, you know, if full effect is given to that argument, then no relief is granted, in which case why have a claim, you know, why recognize a claim for breach of a duty to negotiate in good faith at all?
I don't know
and
why.
Yet we have that. So
I don't agree that no relief is available. I mean, Pharmathene didn't put on evidence of its reliance damages. It takes a shot at what we talk about the evidence we put on. It says our evidence in the courts or our conception of reliance damages is too limited. Well, they had a full opportunity at trial to put on whatever reliance damages they think they suffered. And they didn't do it, Your Honor, because they didn't want reliance damages. They wanted the $400 million to $1 billion. They wanted damages for the deal that never happened and they'd had no right to.
Well, I understand that your side's position rests on the premise that New York law governs this case. And under one of the New York cases, if there is a breach of a promise to negotiate in good faith, then the remedy would be reliance damages, which I assume is the out-of-pocket costs of negotiating in the first place, and of reaching whatever agreement turned out to be breached. Is that fair?
It is some measure of their out-of-pocket costs. It's to okay. what it would take to make them whole, yes.
If we assume, contrary to your position, that Delaware law applies, does that change anything in terms of the analysis?
I don't. It only changes this point, which under New York law, there is a decision of the New York State Highest Court holding flatly that reliance damages are all that's available. I don't think it changes anything because I think that is the law of Delaware, too, and it is the law that this court should make clear to others is the law of Delaware.
But there's no case of this court saying that, is there?
There isn't. No, and that's why Pharmathene ran away from reliance damages because if it was New York law, they weren't going to get any. That's all they were going to get. So, and they didn't want to prove them under any other law because they weren't interested in them. So it would be a great service. I mean, there are many other states in this country that have as a rule of law that all one gets is reliance damages. It's the law in New York. It's the law in Pennsylvania. It's in California, Illinois, and others.
And there are some states that don't recognize a duty to negotiate in good faith.
There's a long list of terms. There's a long list of states that don't recognize that cause of action at all. I will turn to my argument, Your Honor. Your Honors, and as I have the sense you all, everyone already understands, the court below found, and we believe correctly, for 4 reasons at least, that the latch was not a binding contract and that the parties had not agreed to be bound by its terms. First, that the record didn't reflect an agreement to be bound, and at pages 15 and 16 of the lower court's opinion, the court makes the finding first that standing alone, the LATS was not a binding contract, and also that as attached to the bridge loan and attached to the merger agreement, it was not binding, and that the parties had not agreed to be bound by the terms of the LATS in later negotiations. The bridge loan and the merger agreement both showed an understanding that there could be a situation in which there would be no agreement to a LATS after the merger agreement ended. Of course, the LATS on itself, on its face, on every version of it ever produced, and Pharmathene held the pen on this document, every version says on its face this is not a binding contract. The court also, and this is, I thought, perhaps as important as any of it, the court heard evidence and made very careful findings below that there were material missing terms from the LATS agreement that prevented it from being an enforceable contract on its own. It was missing terms regarding funding obligations. The division of responsibility about research and development, which was a crucial issue for my client, the patent prosecution, and many others, and under Delaware law concluded that it meant that the absent terms were material to SIGA and that the contract was not enforceable. The court then erroneously concluded that SIGA had bargained in bad faith. And to begin with, the court was wrong even to consider this question, since Pharmathene hadn't raised the duty to negotiate in good faith in its post-trial opening brief. Nevertheless, and we've talked about that in our briefs, I won't dwell on it, but reaching the merits, the court correctly held that SIGA and Pharmathene were not bound to enter into a license agreement strictly in accordance with the terms of the LATS. Moreover, the court fully understood and exhibited in its opinion its understanding that between January and November of 2006, the economic facts surrounding the LATS had changed dramatically. The court pointed out that both Pharmathene and SIGA had their estimates of the value of the drug had tripled between those two dates. Pharmathene's showed that they thought the drug was worth in excess of $3 billion. The court's opinion also clearly shows the court contemplated that parties would take these developments, these changes in market developments, into account in the negotiations. Yet what the court then does is it erroneously sets forth a standard for bargaining in good faith, which it said that the parties were under a duty to negotiate economic terms substantially similar to those in the LATS. I submit that substantial similarity is not a workable standard for judging people's conduct in negotiations. Parties in a negotiation must know what they can do and what they can't do. And here it would be unknowable under such a standard. The proof of the error the court committed is found in the court's own description of the terms of the transaction. It found the court that parties would have reached if they had bargained in good faith and had reached any deal at all. The court concluded that such a negotiation, which under its standard, as again, was that it had to be substantially similar to the LATS, would have resulted in the upfront and milestone payment obligations going from $16 million to $40 to $45 million, and that the 8 to 12% royalty schedule would have converted into a 50-50 profit split.
What's the matter with engaging in fact-finding, if that's what it is, about future events? I mean, doesn't it happen all the time in sort of personal injury context, trying to predict what someone's circumstance is going to be in the future, or predicting what would happen under a given fact?
Well, the first problem with it here, Your Honor, is that neither party had put on any evidence at trial of what the terms of an agreement would have been had they reached an agreement. So the court was merely reading snippets from testimony about what was said by parties in the negotiation. The second thing is, of course, it's just utter speculation in most instances, and in this case, it was particularly utter speculation. I would point, for example, to the idea that Pharmathene ever would have agreed to the terms the court held would have obtained had they successfully negotiated. The letter from Pharmathene's counsel, Mr. Olstein, he sent a letter on December 6th and another letter on November 30th, and they're in the record at A601 and 602. And they completely give the lie to the idea that Pharmathene would ever have agreed to that combination. It just never would have happened. There's also no evidence, really, that Seagate ever would have agreed to those two things together.
So I take it there's no questioning in the record of, would you have agreed to this term, this term, this term? Answer, yes.
No.
Of course, that issue was dealt with in re-argument, wasn't it? I mean, the argument was
it didn't
made.
Help, it didn't help change the record, Your Honor.
Sorry?
In the court, we made that argument, but the court didn't.
Right.
It didn't expand. There was no expansion of the record. There was nothing more in the record on which he could have found those things, and they're just clearly
the
not.
The point is on re-argument, the parties did address the remedy that the vice chancellor determined would be most just in these circumstances, and Pharmathene said yes, we adhere to that.
I'm sure Pharmathene was quite happy to adhere to what the vice chancellor had awarded them, which could amount to $100 million for zero contribution. Having invested nothing in this drug, they might over the course of this 10
well,
years...
Well, that's an overstatement, isn't it? At least based on the findings that the court made.
Very little, Your Honor. I mean, there's very little in the record, and the court below says it isn't nothing, but it was not much.
Well, $600,000 of money that went to your client from Pharmathene at a time that your client was almost on the ropes.
It was $3 million.
Was used to pay for the first trial.
It was used to pay for a trial that Pharmathene was insisting take place. It was not a trial we were scheduling to have. It was a trial Pharmathene needed, and it was the first human safety testing. It was a trial Pharmathene wanted because they were trying to raise $25 million to pay for the merger, which they had it to do. And they had an investor who wanted to see those results.
The court apparently thought that was a substantial contribution, and I mean, to the extent that your side tries to diminish the importance of it, apparently the trial court didn't buy it.
Trial court didn't agree that it was nothing. Now, that money was repaid, and it was repaid with interest. The whole $3 million was repaid with interest.
But to say that there was no contribution made and, basically skips over a lot of the fact-finding that was done, fact-finding that was adverse to your side.
I must have overstated what I meant to say, Your Honor, and I apologize. Let me say that going back to what the court would have found, what the deal would have been, I mean, from the point of view of establishing a standard for people to follow when they're negotiating, supposedly in good faith, I mean, the court found that we would have ended up at a point that was basically three times what was in the LATS, and this was under a standard of substantial similarity. It says nothing about where we could have begun those negotiations. And indeed, it says nothing about where the negotiations might have broken down. I mean, if we had stuck and our last offer was four times and their last demand was two times, would that have been bad faith? I mean, in the end, the court justifies its decision entirely. It's a question about bad faith. It relies only on the Greca case.
The court relied really, did it not, on the disparity between what Pharmathene was told by Mr. Dravkin, which said you can count on it, you know, it's a done deal, don't worry about it, on the one hand. And on the other hand, the treatment by Seagate of those same economic terms as just being a placeholder or whatever and of having no binding significance at all.
Well, I think the court did that. It's puzzling how something said by Mr. Dravkin in February before the bridge loan agreement was written, before the merger agreement was written, before this obligation to negotiate in good faith was reduced to writing in a fully negotiated, integrated contract between sophisticated people. How it is that something Mr. Dravkin might have said to someone is of any significance at all. If you thought you had that promise from Mr. Dravkin, your obligation was to get it reduced to writing in the merger agreement or in the bridge loan agreement or in both. And they got what they got. And what they got was not a promise that they were going to get a license agreement. They got an agreement to negotiate in good faith over the terms of the lats and so forth. So the court relied, though, basically.
When does the line get crossed then in terms of bad faith? Is it as long as mouths are moving and documents are going back and forth that they always good faith involved, or when? How do you determine it?
I think someone would clearly act in bad faith by negotiating with someone else during the 90-day period. You would act in bad faith by doing that in agreeing to terms that you then refuse to agree to with the person to whom you had the obligation. There are, I'm sure, other imaginable ways in which one could engage in bad faith negotiation, but not budging. I mean, taking a position and not moving from it shouldn't be one of them. People who haven't bound themselves to a contract and haven't bound themselves to the term of a contract cannot be forced into those terms by a court. These courts do not make contracts for people. Contracts are made by bilateral consent, and unless you have both parties agreeing, there can be no agreement. Which is why the remedy the court below constructed is it's essentially a contract that he decided people would have agreed to, and they didn't, and then he imposes on it as by way of a remedy. But as I was saying, the Greca case that the court relies on at this point in his opinion dealt with a situation where the Greca company had already obtained 100% of the performance that was due from RBG or whatever it's called. 100%. They had given their all, and they had nothing left with which to bargain. And then instead of paying what it had agreed to pay, Greca tried to retrade the deal. That is not what happened here. We didn't receive all of the performance due to us under the lats. We didn't get any of the $16 million under the lats. Nothing. So Greca is not the good case, a good case to support this. I mean, the VS&A case decided by Chancellor Allen in 1992 provides a much better example of how Delaware law treats the duty to negotiate in good faith. And what the Chancellor there said in dismissing a complaint, and it was a complaint that alleged that since the economics had changed, the seller had a change of heart and no longer wanted to do the deal on the terms he had preliminarily agreed to do it. It alleged that the seller had affirmatively misled the buyer about its about its interest. Anyway, the Chancellor there said what's crucial is not whether the parties had in fact reached agreement on all material terms, such as you might say we reached agreement on the terms in the lats. What is critical is whether the parties reached agreement to be bound by those terms. And we had not reached that such agreement. Neither had Pharmathene. I see I'm into my rebuttal time. So I think I've covered a good deal of what I wanted to say on the opening part. Let me just stress that the level of speculation involved in the court's award is multiple. First, there's a speculation that there would have been any deal agreed to at all. Then there's a speculation about what the terms of that deal would have been. Fundamentally, there's a speculation that ST-246 will ever earn a profit. And Pharmathene doesn't dispute any of that. I mean, Pharmathene, all it says is, well, if you give us this forced payment stream, it takes care of the profit element of it. It may, but it doesn't take care and it doesn't address the other two more fundamental problems, which is that it is speculative to say that we ever wished to reach an agreement or what the terms of that agreement would have been. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. First, before I get in my argument, I'd like to touch upon some of the issues that came up when Mr. Lamb was speaking. First, the complaint was specifically amended to allege in the fifth count a claim for breach of a covenant of good faith, regardless of whether or not the last was binding. Second, the issue was briefed at length in Pharmathene's opening post-trial brief, being primarily a factual issue, the determination of good faith. It was briefed at length in the factual section, but in the legal section as well, a case was cited for the proposition that under Delaware law, a breach of an obligation to negotiate in good faith may be specifically enforced.
And the vice chancellor so found both in his original decision, well, and in the motion for re-argument. Mention was made that no evidence was put in about what the parties would have agreed to. Well, that's not true. In addition to Mr. Olstein's letter, which clearly offered to do a 50-50 profit split, and in fact, SIGA never budged from its lapse. If you recall, in the first post-merger meeting, they were asked what they had to propose after Pharmathing said everybody was bound by the terms of the lapse, and they threw out $40 million up front and a 50-50 profit split. That was based on an internal memo by their controller, who was asked to estimate what the payment should be if there was 50-50 profit split. And Ms. Gagheri came up with a memo saying it should be $39 million, because that's the cost to date plus cost to complete development, and that would support a 50-50 profit split.
Is it your position that no matter what change of circumstances may occur between an agreement like a lapse and then the ultimate negotiation, there will always be bad faith if you begin the negotiation with a different set of terms?
Yes, and I think that's the case not only under Delaware law, Your Honor, and we've cited case authority, not just Greco, but other cases for that proposition, but it's also the true under New York law. There's a very well-known case, totally unaddressed by SIGA in his papers, the teacher's insurance case. It's cited in our brief. It's a federal case, Southern District applying New York law, and it's been cited repeatedly. And in that case, the court specifically said that if parties come to agreement on specified terms, even though they remain terms to be determined, it's a breach of that agreement to go back and try to change those terms. That's what happened here. So whether you're under New York law or Delaware, you get to the same place, Your Honor.
Even if there are circumstances that are unanticipated?
None of these, even if there are circumstances that were unanticipated. But I submit the circumstances that happened here were all anticipated and considered by the parties when they were negotiating in January. They knew they were going to do tests on safety. They knew they were going to do tests in primates to see if it worked. $3 million was being provided to help facilitate all these things, to move the research forward. And granted, in January, this drug might have gone nowhere, and the $3 million would have been lost. But the $3 million saved it. And everybody anticipated that if these tests were successful, it would become a drug worth billions of dollars. The estimated market by Dugarry that's sent to us, Pharmathing, in January, estimates the market in billions of dollars. So everybody knew that was the potential for this drug, knew the government was committed to buying it and has bought it, and knew the government was committing to fund it, which it did. Actually, all this $39 million that she talks about was government money. It wasn't SIGA's money.
I'd like to move to a different topic.
Yes, sir.
Is it uncontested that if New York law is the governing law, then the remedy would be limited to reliance damages?
Now, that's heavily contested, Your Honor. The main case for that proposition.
The answer, yes. The reliance damages would be the remedy.
No. Under New York law, we believe expectancy damages could also be appropriate.
Okay.
Let me explain why I say that, Your Honor.
I'll let you do that, but I gather then that the choice of law issue was not critical.
Well, I think there's more case law under Delaware law, and it's, I think, the result to support Vice Chancellor Parsons' decision is clearer under Delaware law, but I don't think it's clear that New York law forecloses, and I'll explain why. The case that's relied upon is the Goodstein case, and in that case, a real estate developer was negotiating with the city of New York about some real estate. The court specifically found that at no point was the city of New York obligated to accept any terms proposed by the real estate developer. Quite different here. Furthermore, had the city reached agreement on anything, the Board of Standards was obligated to decide whether to approve that contract and had no obligation to approve the contract. And what the court concluded here is we don't have any terms on which to measure damages, since there's no terms that ever been agreed upon. And since there are no terms upon which to base damages, how can we come up with damages? Here is just the opposite. The court below found that all the economic terms of the transaction had been agreed upon by the parties and embodied in the lapse. All the economic terms are there. And then in an intense factual analysis, it found that based on, well, first the language, committing the parties to negotiate in good faith, with the intention of executing a definitive license agreement in accordance with the terms of the LATS, that language obligated the parties to those terms, or terms substantially similar. It found that there are 3 weeks, 4 weeks of negotiation in January over those specific terms supported that finding, and it found that the parties' conduct afterwards supported that finding. It was an intense, and Justice Ridgely asked me, as I asked earlier, if it was an intensely factual finding about good faith, and it was, sir. And I believe the standard that would be applied would be clearly erroneous to Judge Parsons' conclusions, Vice Chancellor Parsons' conclusions. Now,
can you conceive of a circumstance where people would negotiate in good faith and simply not agree, and then there would be no cause of action?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And if that term sheet had not been attached to these documents, and there had been a general obligation to negotiate in good faith, that would be precisely the case. There would be circumstances there, either where parties would be free to propose whatever terms they wanted, or if in fact there was a finding of bad faith, there would be no terms in which to base a remedy, unlike this case. Take the VS&A case that's been quoted as authority as opposed to GRECA, and this is really right on all fours with GRECA. In VS&A, the court specifically found that the agreement at the issue spelled out in a paragraph that none of the terms were binding in any way on the parties. In this case, there was such a paragraph. There was originally a merger letter of intent before the merger agreement. That letter of intent had language just like that. These terms aren't binding on the parties. There's no binding obligation until the parties execute a formal document and do due diligence. That's not the case once the merger agreement is signed and the bridge loan agreement is signed and the last is attached. The only phrase in that document, the non-binding, is a footer at the bottom of the page that wasn't removed when it was attached, a footer that was last put there in January 26, months before the bridge loan agreement and months before the merger agreement. The merger agreement and the bridge loan agreement, by their terms, incorporate the terms of the LATS, not a footer. This court has held repeatedly that in interpreting contracts, you look at the overall agreement. You don't, and with the intent of giving each paragraph its meaning. Here, the clear words of in accordance with the terms are, those are the terms of the deal. And if there was any mistake here by Judge Parsons, Vice Chancellor Parsons, and we don't believe there was, then it was by not finding that those terms were locked in completely, and which is the reason why we cross appealed.
Your view of the case, if I understand it correctly, is that the parties were obligated to negotiate in good faith, but only as to those items that were not already agreed to in the term sheet.
That's absolutely correct.
Economic terms. It would have been all the other matters that Vice Chancellor Parsons said were not covered,
which we don't consider, well, believe, or material for reasons explained in our brief. But correct. The answer to your question is that's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Right. But on the issue of remedy, and I already made this point, however, inartfully to opposing counsel, isn't there something inherently problematic about a cause of action for breach of the duty to negotiate in good faith? Even under Delaware law, we firmly and I think uniformly hold that damages cannot be speculative. But there's something inherently speculative in any attempt to get a remedy on the cause of action on which you prevailed, because it presupposes that there would be some kind of successful outcome to the negotiation, which in fact may or may not be the case. And that being true, if it is true, then that would make reliance measure of damages fairly attractive, because that would be the only remedy that wouldn't be speculative. That is, that we know or would know how much Pharmathene laid out in terms of hard cash to get to the point where it did until the breach occurred. So the question is, how does one avoid the rule against speculative damages with the kind of remedy that in fact was awarded, with the court having found that expectation damages would not be awardable here?
I think under the very, very unique facts of this case, that is not a problem, and I'll explain why. The parties have researched cases from not only Delaware but other jurisdictions, and the closest case that we found was Greca. The closest case that SIGA claims is the SNA, which is, as for the reasons stated, easily distinguishable. And the reason is, in these good faith cases, you do not have a situation where all the economic terms of the deal have been found and agreed upon. And the Chancery Court found that all the economic terms of the deal were in the lapse. The other terms were missing, like choice of law, did not involve the economics of the transaction. The parties then specifically obligated themselves to negotiate and execute a definitive document in accordance with those economic terms. So you're not making broad law here, Your Honor. You're dealing with a very fact-intensive case. And the reason for it's not speculative is you have the economics of the deal agreed upon. And as if the Vice Chancellor were wrong, and I'll explain why I don't think he was wrong, then the remedy would be one of the ones we proposed, which was an income stream based on the economic terms of the lapse. And we put in expert testimony on that, which said it was 48% of the revenues, the gross revenues, and which was unrebutted. And so here you have the unique situation of the economics are laid out, unlike Goodstein, where there were no economics laid out. The economics are laid out for you. And one of the reasons why Greca is applicable, Your Honor.
Well, doesn't the logic of the argument that you just made point to a specific dollar figure in expectation damages?
Well, we gave a dollar figure based on what the parties knew at the time of the breach. Bear in mind, at the time of the breach, we also have a unique fact. Siegel was taking the position that this drug was worth $5 billion. And that's what we're trying to justify.
All I'm asking is, if all the economic terms were agreed to, and damage calculations being a matter of economics and arithmetic, then wouldn't it follow that the remedy that you are really arguing for and would flow from the breach of place here would be a specific dollar figure, which would be your client's expectation of whatever benefit would result had there been a contract?
We put in lengthy reports and expert testimony from three witnesses that showed that the best valuation of what damages were in a lump sum based on what was known at the date of the breach was $1 billion. In order to deal with the possibility, though everybody believed this drug.
It was a range of anywhere between $400 million and $1 billion, right?
No, well, it was, but not as of the date. The valuation was done based on what was known as the date of the breach, November 2006. That was $1 billion. A second valuation was put in based on what was known 2 years later. That was also $1 billion. Finally, when we tried the case, it looked like instead of buying $2.8 billion all at once of this drug, BARDA was going to buy $500 million and then buy maybe another $2 billion. And instead of a shelf life of 3 years, it might have a shelf life now of 5 years. That's what brought the number down to $400 million. But that's what was based on what the parties knew at the time of trial. Based on the parties' expectations at the date of breach, which is the law according to this court, the best valuation was $1 billion. To take into account any possible claim of speculation.
A final agreement had been drafted, and executed, which is unknowable at the time. I mean, isn't that the inherent speculation that's built in to or embedded in a cause of action for breach of the duty to negotiate and convey?
We put on expert testimony, but I'll answer why I think the court was, the Vice Chancellor Parsons was right. We put on expert testimony that this agreement contained and compared it to other documents filed with the SEC, which were binding agreements. And this agreement contained more terms than those agreements did. The terms that the court found were missing and not ordering specific performance, and we believe he should have ordered specific performance, aren't in those binding agreements, such as choice of law. They talk about funding obligations. Well, Pharmathene was obligated to fund the full development of this drug. Everything you needed to enforce an agreement is here. So,
but the court, whole reason, I'm sorry.
The court disagreed with you.
The court certainly disagreed, which is why we cross-appealed on that issue. But can I go just one more piece, answer that question, sir? Thank you. But that's also why we offered an alternative of a cash flow based on the economics of the lapse, which the court had. And that alternative, we gave a percentage. It was 48% of the gross revenues.
That's what I want to ask you about, because the court rejected your expectation damages expert, correct? Or basically,
yes, yes.
It's not a single sum that could be awarded now.
The court did that. That's correct, sir.
All right. And in the Goodstein case, the New York court says that there must be, quoting Hadley versus Baxendale from mm-hmm. law school days, that the particular damages were fairly within the contemplation of the parties to the contract at the time it was made. And if the Court of Chancery could not come up with a single figure, how could the parties have come up with a single figure at the time the contract was made?
Well, we have a figure when the January negotiations took place of in excess of $1 billion valued by SIGA. When they breached by negotiating in bad faith and rejecting the terms they had agreed to, their figure was $5 billion. So there's no question that Pharmathene was harmed. It had the right to sublicense this thing. Had it received the license with the economic terms it was entitled to, it could have turned around and sold it. According to SIGA, it was now worth $360 million in upfront and milestone payments, plus royalties of 18% to 22%, plus they still kept the 50-50 profit split on top of the 20% margin to the federal government, and then they got another 50-50 profit split on top of that 50-50 profit split. So by their own token, this was a valuable product. We had the economic terms that we're entitled to were laid out. And I'd like to go back and remind the court, which it sure knows, is this product was dead in the water in January of 2006. Mr. Perlman, McAndrews and Forbes, through Mr. Drapkin, had made the decision not to fund. And it was going nowhere without our money. We saved it. We moved it along from a very speculative product to one people thought were worth billions of dollars.
And the Court of Chancery recognized that.
Yes, Your Honor.
I have a question that may fit into the category of silly, but I'm going to ask it anyway because it relates to a comment that you made in your side's brief about promissory estoppel, which was one of the causes of action that your side prevailed on. When I was in law school about 100 years ago, promissory estoppel was simply a name or a description given to a doctrine that applied only as a substitute for consideration in a contract case. It now seems to have migrated into broader application. And my question is, are we really talking about promissory estoppel here in the classic sense or equitable estoppel?
Well, it has migrated, Your Honor, both in this court's decisions and in the decisions of the Chancery Court. In fact, there's specific language in one of the principal cases cited by SIGA where they talk about, trying to get the name of the case for this court. It was also in the Grunstein case, which they cite. And
well, the doctrine that you prevailed on.
Well, yes,
it's not just a technical. Isn't restricted just to the consideration element of a contract, correct? It's really equitable estoppel dressed up in old language.
Well, let me read, if you don't mind, quote from the Ramon case, that one of the cases they rely on. And it says, promissory estoppel is more accurately described as a particular application or subcategory of the general doctrine of equitable estoppel, rather than as a principle of contract law that operates as a substitute for consideration. And that's precisely how it was treated here, Your Honor. And in fact, being an equitable remedy, it also entitles us to equitable relief, which is what the judge did here. And they argue that promissory estoppel is foreclosed by the written agreements, but the written agreements have to cover the subject matter at issue in litigation, and the subject matter at issue here were the applicability of the terms of the lapse.
They argue that, and they also argue that whatever remedy, if any, you're entitled to would be at law.
Pardon?
Not that year, that you have an adequate remedy of law.
Well, let me address both of those, Your Honor. The first is and but an issue is here is the application of the terms of the lapse. The court found that document was non-binding. Therefore, there is no contract that precludes the application of promissory estoppel. Furthermore, promissory estoppel, you're not supposed to use it to change or alter the terms of a written agreement. We're not seeking to change or alter the terms of any written agreement. We're seeking to enforce the lapse. So promissory estoppel is applicable here just like it was in Greca. And I missed the second part of Your Honor's question. I think there were two parts to it.
I think related to the argument being made by the other side that your client had an adequate remedy of law.
Well, the courts talk about that, and the adequate remedy of law is viewed as a practical matter. Is the remedy practically an adequate remedy for the harm that's been created? And here, $200,000 in reliance damages for a multi-billion dollar drug, which we saved and brought and moved when it was dead in the water, is hardly as a practical matter an adequate remedy of law. And the courts have addressed that, both here and below, and found when as a practical matter there is a legal remedy, but it's not adequate to make up for the wrong, they've applied equitable remedies. And I want to go to the remedy, Your Honor, because what we're really dealing here is not new law. It's very old, tried and true law, the imposition of a constructive trust. Whenever a court applies forms of constructive trust, it imposes contractual conditions on the parties that they have not agreed to. And Vice Chancellor Parsons in his decision talks about, should I have a remedy based on the economic terms of the lapse?
Most constructive trust cases involve a specific identified piece of property where title is shifted from the wrongdoer to the beneficiary that's held to be entitled to it. Here we're talking about a constructive trust essentially on an income stream that may or may not come into existence.
Well, the IB biomedical case, which was decided by then Vice Chancellor Steele, is right on point. In that case, Company A had biotechnology technology, and it licensed it to Company B, who also had similar related technology. And the deal was if B used A's technology to develop something new, it had to license it back. A would own it.
This is really an equitable license agreement, isn't it?
It's a cash flow based on the economic terms that would have been in the license. But could I finish with IB Biomedical? And B used A's technology, lied to A, said we didn't use it, then licensed the technology to a university. And a Vice Chancellor Steele imposed a constructive trust on the funds B was receiving from that university in the favor of A. I think that's very analogous to the facts here, Your Honor, and answers your question, I hope. If in fact this court finds that a constructive trust was not appropriate, we believe that an income stream based on the economic terms of the lapse, which again, I repeat, the judge, Vice Chancellor below found all the economic terms were there. All had been agreed upon. And we put in evidence of what a cash flow would be based on that. Also because of all the economic terms are there, we believe we're entitled to specific performance. What the parties, what SIGA had to do under the terms of that contract, which was delineated in a committee, has been done. What remains to be do were the things that PharmaThing is supposed to do. All they need to do is sit back and collect royalties. Well, if we get specific performance, will we go forward and market the drug? With respect to overseeing this, Your Honor, the question you asked, it's a 10 years at issue, but the court specifically declined to retain jurisdiction. It's the terms are there, and just as if you had a contract between these parties, there's no reason to assume the court would be ever involved again, especially if people act appropriately.
Mr. Crane, you're out of time.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honors, Mr. Crane said, in response to his question, the questions from the court, he said that the court below had found that all the economic terms of the lats had been agreed upon. That's precisely what the court below did not find. The court found that there had parties reached an interim agreement in January but specifically found that the parties had never agreed to be bound by those terms, that the LATS itself was not an enforceable contract, and that in the later anticipated negotiations, the parties would not be strictly bound to the terms set forth in the LATS. So I don't know what Mr. Crane was referring to, but he basically conceded in his argument, in answer to that question, that for them to succeed, they need to have those terms that in the LATS be binding on the parties in the course of the negotiation, which is exactly what the court below refused to find. The TIA insurance, the Teachers Insurance and Annuity Company case in New York, it's a wonderful case for us. I mean, it's a very learned decision by Judge LaValle in New York that goes through discussing all the different kinds of agreements like this there might be. And when Mr. Crane said he was prepared to specifically enforce an agreement where the parties had reached an agreement, he did, but only if the evidence showed that the parties had committed themselves, had agreed to be bound by the terms of that contract. That's what's wrong with this case. I mean, you can have an interim, you can have a binding term sheet, but it needs to say, the parties need expressly to say, we are bound by the terms of this term sheet in our later negotiation. We are committed to these terms. You can do it by saying that on the term sheet. You could do it by saying it in the bridge loan, or you could do it by signing the document, none of which happened.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we'll also take a brief recess.